Hello, welcome to the Kojit podcast series. My name is Anthony Richards and I'm the editorial director of Kojit. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Professor Maura Conway. Maura is Professor of International Security in the School of Law and Government at Dublin City University, and she's also the coordinator of VoxPol, an EU-funded project on violent online political extremism. Maura, thank you so much for joining me today.
No problem, Anthony. Happy to contribute.
Thank you very much. I suppose my first question is, I wonder if you can clarify in terms of the parameters of the focus of your research. Is it just violent extremism and terrorism that you're focusing on, or is it extremism more broadly as well? And how important do you think that distinction is?
Yeah, so this is an interesting question, and this is something I come back to quite a lot, or I reflect on at least quite a lot. I haven't written very widely on conceptualizations of terrorism or extremism or violent extremism or any of their online variants other than cyber terrorism, which we might get to. But at the same time, it is something that I have a tendency to reflect on quite a lot, I think, because this is something that is complex in itself, this question about conceptualizing extremism and terrorism and what have you. And it gets more complicated, I think, when you're doing work that's largely about the online setting, which is where my main interest lies. So I guess the first thing that I would generally say is that for me, terrorism is something that you do. And for me, up to the present, it's largely something that's done in so-called real-world settings. So I think that's an important place to start. You yourself have done work in this area that I think is quite useful about precisely, you know, what we mean then when we say extremism, and what does it mean for, say, counterterrorism practice, for example. And so for me, when I think about extremism, then I'm thinking more oftentimes about ideas and perhaps also online activity of a variety of sorts that's about, you know, forwarding or promulgating certain types of ideas. So that's one aspect of the thing, at least for me. The second thing I guess I would say is that then is this distinction between extremism broadly and violent extremism on the other hand. And in VoxPol, for example, when I and others were thinking about the project, one of the things that we did, so VoxPol basically stands for violent online political extremism. So it's violent extremism that we were interested in and that I certainly remain interested in. And I think one of the things that a focus on violent extremism does is it's more objective, I think, than a broader extremism category. So right off, it has this more objective aspect to the extent that any of us can be objective. But it's generally not, say, me and my research then deciding whether somebody is an extremist or not, because when you introduce violence into the equation, so when the actor or the user or whomever, the group or the movement that we're focused on as researchers introduces violence into the equation, well, that to me takes out some of the subjectivity, because they've sort of outed themselves as extremists because of their willingness to employ violence to resolve sort of social and political conflicts and what have you. However, and so I would say that my focus of my research has largely been on violent extremists and terrorists, largely in the online space. But I guess the third point I would make is that I think we see more and more instances in which acts of terrorism, in fact, not just violent extremism, but actual terrorist attacks. And the attackers have plainly been influenced by what's not commonly conceived to be violent extremist ideology. Sometimes now it's not even conceived to be extremist ideology, depending on whom you might be interacting with. But it's of a far right nature, let's say, oftentimes, that has fortunately entered into the mainstream. And so for that reason, when we think about, you know, ideas like the Great Replacement or white genocide or some incel ideology and what have you, well, we can certainly point to attacks that I think on any definition are terrorist attacks, but have been influenced by, you know, what's at a minimum extremist rather than explicitly violent extremist ideology. And so for that reason, I don't think we as terrorism scholars can dispense wholly with the extremism category. Though I take the point that you made in your international affairs article around, you know, having a certain carefulness. And you'll notice I said we as scholars, because there, I think there's a whole other raft of things that come into play if we begin to talk about counterterrorism practitioners and that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Thank you very much for that overview. A number of really interesting points in there. I mean, in that context then, to what extent do you think cyber terrorism is a useful concept to employ? I have debates with my students regularly about this. You know, what is it, if we really think that cyber terrorism is a valid concept, what is it that takes place online that would find itself into that conceptual space of terrorism in order to be labeled type cyber terrorism? Well, what's your view on that?
Yeah, so I have a long I have a long association, and I've reflected lengthily and for a long time on this question of, you know, what is cyber terrorism and is it real and is it not? And you're right, it's a thing that students in particular are really taken with a lot of the time, and you can get into to good debates about it. I first wrote about this probably now about 20 years ago. So, and you know, it's funny that it still keeps coming up again and again, and interesting to me. I am somebody who feels like there is some utility in the term cyber terrorism. Let me say for starters that I don't like the term cyber terror. And I'll tell you why that is. It's because in media, but actually some scholars and others have done this too, they use this term cyber terror, and it's hugely, hugely wide. And really they mean anything bad that happens on the internet. And so that's not useful. And so just like with real world terrorism, the ism is a really important part when it comes to cyber also. So cyber terrorism must at the very least have a political or a socio-political motive, I would say. So that's one important factor. Second aspect is that for me, it does not include the kind of, if you want, PR type activity, influence operations, however you would like to describe them, that I'm generally concerned with. The rest of my research and a wide range of colleagues have written about, so what's sometimes referred to as online terrorism or online extremism and terrorism and what have you, right? So there's a reason that we're all using that terminology rather generally than cyber terrorism, because those PR type propaganda info ops campaigns carried out by so-called Islamic State or a whole raft of other actors, that's not cyber terrorism, I would say. So when we're talking about cyber terrorism, we would talk about, we're best to talk about, in my opinion, the use of the internet to carry out an attack, either on other IT infrastructures or in a sort of a, also with the possibility of having a real world effects, obviously, also. You know, that's less PR and more sort of kinetic, you know. The skills and knowledge that you need for the type of PR campaigns, I would say, are largely different for the skills and knowledge that you would need to carry out a cyber attack that could, for the sorts of political purposes that by sub-state actors that we might then describe as cyber terrorism. You know, having said all this, Richard Jackson and Daniela Pizzoiu, back now in, I think, 2017, 2018, asked me to write a chapter for their textbook called Contemporary Debates on Terrorism, where they needed somebody to write a chapter saying, no, cyber terrorism, it's nonsense. And they needed somebody to say, write a chapter saying, absolutely not, it's a real thing, etc. So the funny part is, Miriam Duncavelty put up her hand and said she would write the chapter, which she duly did, where she argued, you know, it's kind of a media narrative and whatnot. And for the most part, it's, you know, completely blown out of proportion and misunderstood and what have you. And they couldn't find anybody to write the other chapter. So they had to, they pressured me into it. And, you know, it was a funny one because turns out it's quite difficult to, and painful really, to write something that you're not wholly convinced of or really convinced of at all. But, you know, at the same time, Anthony, it was definitely a worthwhile sort of thought experiment, if you like. And as I say to people when this comes up quite often, and now I'm right either way, which is a good position to be in, you know?
Absolutely fantastic. So actually, what you're kind of suggesting, I guess, and you know, we perhaps shouldn't really call something cyber terrorism unless it satisfies the definition of terrorism in general.
Correct.
So in other words, it has to be violence or the threat of violence, psychological yes. motive, political motive, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So that's very interesting. Yeah, there's, thanks for that clarity on that. Well, my next question revolves around a piece that you wrote for the Voxbol website, and it was entitled, "We Need a Visual Turn in Violent Online Extremism Research." And I wonder if you could elaborate a bit further as to what you mean by this visual turn.
Yeah, absolutely. So anybody who is familiar with, for example, international relations as a sub-discipline, which is a lot of colleagues who are terrorism scholars, or indeed, you know, with a host of disciplines and sub-disciplines in social sciences and humanities generally, will know that visual turns took place within these disciplines and sub-disciplines, some of them starting as long as about sort of 30 years ago now. So in the 1990s, actually, was when this became a thing, if you like. So an insistence that in social sciences and humanities that we not focus so wholly on text, and instead where relevant that we also take account of images and analyze those images in conjunction also with text or audio or what have you, where that was relevant also. And like I say, a lot of this focus on visuals began in the 1990s. IR was kind of late to this particular party, if you like, and the focus on visuals probably started in the 2000s. And there's great work being done since by scholars like Roland Bleicher and a host of others. But in fact, I would say, even though things have improved considerably in the last number of years, there really is a dearth of work on visuals in terrorism studies. And I find it particularly interesting that there's so little work, especially when we look at the online, because clearly Web 2.0, one of its core characteristics is it's the visual web in effect. And we're not just talking about still images, though those are plainly important, but moving images are absolutely a core component of Web 2.0. So video. And for me, it's been interesting the way in which we have still, as terrorism scholars, really stuck to text. And I have to say now, this is a definite we. I'm not really pointing to others. I'm definitely falling to this category also. So I completely understand why this is the case. You know, it's much more straightforward to study text. And I think one of the reasons, for example, that ISIS and other jihadi magazines were analyzed so widely is because they were, you know, really good and useful sources of data, of text data. Now, interestingly, they're also very, very heavy on images. But the images have been much, much less analyzed than the text. And the same is true of IS. At one point, probably at their high point in 2015, so-called Islamic State were producing a couple of videos a day, like 15 videos a week. They produced hundreds and hundreds of videos. And yet the videos really haven't been studied extensively, given the very, very wide array of them. And also their relatively easy accessibility, even right up to the present time, even taking into account deplatforming and what have you. And I understand why. It's still images are more difficult than text to analyze. Videos are more difficult than still images to analyze. And if you're going to do more multimodal analysis, so do analyses of videos taking into account not just the moving images, but also the other aspects like the technical aspects of the video, the sound, etc. That's even more difficult. But nevertheless, I think this issue of visuals is one that definitely warrants greater attention. Yeah. And there is more work being done. There has been more work done since I wrote on the images in the jihadi magazines, for example. There is work that's been done. Shout out to, you know, Corey Dauber, Tawida Moran, Anthony Lemieux, Carol Winkler, and others who've done work on jihadi videos, for example. Wida and colleagues have done work on Taliban videos. That's multimodal type analyses. So I'm absolutely not dismissing the work that's been done. It's just that my feeling is that we could definitely do better. And I'll say one final thing about this, which is that the stuff that I've talked about so far, it's really obvious. So these are the ISIS photo arrays, extreme right memes, the magazines, the images in the magazines. These are really obvious visuals to analyze. But I do think there's a whole host of other visuals outside of the online setting, but also within the online setting that bear analyzing. And I would say, for example, I've been working for some time now on with colleagues on getting something out there about, for example, profile pictures. But I think useful work could also be done on, for example, the use of emojis in extremist and violent extremist and terrorism settings and what have you. So I guess what I'm calling those is sort of more non-obvious images, if you like.
Yeah, very interesting. Thank you for that. If I could turn our attention towards a very extensively read piece that you wrote for, a very important piece of work that you wrote for Studies in Conflict and Terrorism in 2017. And it was entitled Determining the Role of the Internet in Violent Extremism and Terrorism, Six Suggestions for Progressing Research. And I would urge our listeners certainly to read that because it is a very, very important contribution to the discipline. Within that, you talk about the need to include interviewing and virtual ethnographic approaches. Some have called it netnography, I think, haven't they? How would you suggest going about this?
Yeah, so again, an acknowledgement that one of the reasons that not a lot of this type of work has been done to date is that it's more difficult than going back to our sort of starting place seems to be text, right? It's a lot more difficult to collect data in these ways. And that's for a variety of reasons. I will say that there is a history of interviewing within terrorism studies. There are, various colleagues going back to, I think, probably the 1980s, the 1990s, who did carry out interviews with people who are members of terrorist organizations. And I think some of that work is always worth going back to, certainly. Having said that, all the work is not historical in nature. There are colleagues who have indeed carried out work more recently. And because I always come back to online, one of the ways in which they've been able to do that is because they reached out to people online and carried out these interviews oftentimes via virtual means. So, for example, Lauren Dawson and Amar Singham have an article that's worth reading where they interviewed foreign fighters who went to Iraq and Syria. And some colleagues from, interestingly, anthropology also did work on so-called jihadi brides. So they have an interesting sort of a note. It's about basically chatting about marriage with female migrants to Syria. That's Aisha Navest and her colleagues. And I'm sure others can think of other instances in which interviewing has indeed been undertaken. You know, one of the reasons, obviously, that this area is more difficult than others, or this methodology, if you like, is more difficult than others, is, of course, that there are a plethora of issues arising if you're actually going to interview people who are currently involved with a terrorist organization. In some jurisdictions, there are definitely legal issues, but even absent those, you know, you're definitely going to run into an issue with your IRB, or so your Institutional Review Board, or your Research Ethics Committee in a university setting. And you know, I think that's appropriate because this isn't something that you, you want to undertake without thinking about it very deeply. You know, what are the appropriate ways to do this? How can you, protect yourself and others, etc. Of course, another way that people have done more interviewing is to talk to farmers, and there's increasing amounts of work that draw on their on their experiences. As some people are a long time out of, say, for example, violent jihadism, the extreme right, neo-Nazism, Irish republicanism, etc. But others are much more recently removed from some of these settings. So Ryan Scrivens and his colleagues, Daniel Kohler, and some others have done good work in this area. I guess, just to go back for a moment, what I would say is that, the possibility of actually talking to people who, and interviewing people who are engaged presently in let's call it the violent extremism or sort of terrorism realms, the internet does have a utility in that respect, because obviously there's a pretty significant difference between having to travel to some conflict zone, for example, versus speaking to somebody virtually who may be active in the conflict zone, but with all the caveats that I've already, you know, listed, still applying. As regards online ethnography, you know, I think this is a really interesting one. I think there are definite possibilities there. There's a lot of work that's been done about how to do what's sometimes called online ethnography, what's sometimes called virtual anthropology, what CosiNets calls netnography, etc. There's a lot of useful how-tos. So that's one thing. Most of the work that's been done has been done in quite benign settings. It's certainly been shown to be useful within those settings, which leads me to believe it would definitely be useful within online extremism and terrorism settings. But then once again, you're back to the variety of issues that then come into play that don't come into play if you're studying, you know, online bird watchers or something, you know. I think there is possibilities there. Once again, I do think that in order to do some of that work, you are going to be faced with making a lot of explanations to research ethics committees and the like. But again, some of this work has been done. So like I say, a lot of the work that has been done outside of extremism and terrorism studies is in quite benign settings. But there are definitely people who have done work that are in settings that are more akin to online extremism and terrorism settings. Like, for example, online drug marketplaces and this kind of thing in various darknet type settings and what have you. So they have shown how it can be done and done successfully while paying attention to all of the variety of ethics and related issues. So I would point colleagues and, you know, PhD students and others who are interested in maybe this kind of a more engaged type of an approach to some of the work that's been undertaken by internet researchers outside of the online extremism and terrorism researcher community, certainly, because I've certainly benefited when I've been thinking about online extremism and terrorism research ethics related issues with reading some of the work from colleagues outside of our own discipline and the things that they have grappled with and how they have resolved some of the issues that have arisen. And I certainly think that some of their learnings are useful to ourselves.
In your work, you've also emphasized the need to pay more attention to gender as a factor behind online extremism and online terrorism. I wonder if you could elaborate further on that as well.
Yeah, you know, this is an interesting one. So I think there's at least two, but probably many more aspects to this. So quite a lot of the time, you know, when people say gender, they actually mean women, in which case I think you should just say women. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. No. I think there's a whole host of issues that arise when we think about the role of women in extremism and terrorism. And for myself, like I say, I'm interested in the role of women in online extremism and terrorism. So the actual behaviors, online behaviors and activity of female internet users who are active in violent extremist or terrorist online spaces, I think is something that hasn't received enough attention to date. So what we see again is more of a focus on content. So content that's targeted at women, whether they're female jihadis or whether they are, you know, women involved in right-wing extremism, for example. And there is definitely some interesting work that is coming out that speaks both to female users, female influencers, if you like, and the nature of the content. For example, useful work about, you know, females and their roles in the QAnon community, for example, or again, you know, wellness communities, which are dominated by women, but which increasingly corners of them certainly, you know, have this sort of extreme right activity ongoing. Some of it arising out of COVID-19 anti-vax activity and what have you. So like I say, some of gender is about female users, women and girls and, you know, content targeted at them by extremist and terrorist groups and movements, but also their roles in extremist and terrorist groups and movements. But it's not just obviously about women. When we say gender, there is at least also males. And I think this is an important aspect that has been largely overlooked. And I would really like to see more research that that addresses, you know, issues around masculinity and ideas about masculinity and, you know, how these are playing out within extremist and terrorist organizations, including particularly for me, again, in online settings. Really is something that there is not a great deal of research on. But as far as I'm concerned, there's actually tons of data that could be utilized, analyzed for exploring those kinds of ideas. And then I guess I would say, at the very least, there's a third aspect, which is around the LGBTQ plus community. I would say the way in which they are targets of quite a lot of hate and extremism, obviously, they're one of the groups that are certainly significant targets, including online. It's very it's very obvious that they are targets of extreme right-wing activity and activists, but also of jihadists, for example. And so there's definitely, I think, work still to be done with regard to, the targeting of the LGBTQ plus community, and also maybe thinking further about people who are members of that community, about doing work that takes into account, feminist and queer and other type theories and methodologies too, and how that might contribute, to work in this area. And like I say, that's kind of the least of it. If I think things through, I guess one of the things that I mentioned very briefly already as well, and it sort of brings actually quite a lot of this together with respect respect to gender is the debates ongoing about the incel community and, you know, this question of whether attacks that have been carried out globally, probably at this stage, but certainly in the US, the UK, Canada, and indeed elsewhere, that appear to be, I think to many, to be terrorist attacks, but are dismissed by others for a variety of reasons as not falling into the category of terrorism. You know, I think there is questions arising there about what makes something an ideology or not, whether gendered ideas cause some people to not to view this as ideological. I think certainly, you know, a lot of the discussions in incel communities take into account many of the things I've already pointed to. So the roles of women, etc., their ideas about women, which are deeply misogynistic, obviously, but also their own ideas about the mostly male users, obviously, and their own ideas about what makes a man, etc. So ideas about masculinity and indeed femininity. And then comes into this as well, the discussions, you know, about LGBTQ, etc. So this question of gender is a complex one. I think we have, you know, over the last handful of years, definitely begun to see a lot more attention to the role of women. But I think we could do better in terms of, you know, broader conceptualizations of gender and, you know, trying to think through what a more expansive, you know, research agenda, gendered research agenda might look like.
Yeah, that's excellent. Thank you very much. There are a number of really interesting research suggestions there. If I could go on to ask you what perhaps for many might seem like a perennial question now, which is, are the so-called social media giants doing enough to tackle online extremism and terrorism? It's a very broad question, and I'm sure there isn't a simple answer to this, but what's your take on that?
So I think the social media giants, so in particular, right? I think most of them have, all of them have endeavored to do work in this area over the last probably decade at this stage. It started from a very low point, obviously, and, you know, it has increased in terms of the number of people that they have tasked in this area, in terms of the variety of approaches that they have begun to take, and what have you. So I don't think there's any doubt about that. The problem, I think, is that, you know, some of these in particular very large companies like Facebook and Google, so YouTube, etc., the problems that they face are also massive problems. And so the fact that they have, you know, upped their game in many respects isn't really sufficient. But, you know, whether they can really up it sufficiently to, you know, account for the mass of issues and harms that are being caused is a tricky question. That's one thing. I also don't feel like this can be all about just the social media companies. So I'm certainly somebody who feels that, you know, regulation is appropriate. You know, certainly in European settings, let's call them, regulation is widespread across every facet of life, and is viewed generally as appropriate. And so I don't see that the online setting or internet companies should be able to escape regulation any more than car manufacturers or, you know, cigarette companies and or what have you. So for me, you know, the job of government, or one of the jobs of government, is to regulate. And we're beginning to see this more and more around the world with respect to online, which I think is generally appropriate. On the other hand, it's certainly the case that a lot of this regulation needs refining. It does need to be thought through to a greater extent than at present. I'm not somebody, though, who subscribes to this idea that somehow the online space is so complex that it can't be regulated for. You know, there are all kinds of complex settings, again, back to automobiles, aviation, nuclear energy, etc., that are all regulated for, you know, global finance and what have you. I don't see any reason why the internet would escape. On the contrary, in fact. I do think, like I say, that a lot of this legislation is going to need refining, over time. And we're going to have to figure out what works, probably, unfortunately, you know, via a process of trial and error. But nevertheless, for me, that's a really important, a very important next step, and that's appropriate that, you know, government would legislate. Users would have recourse to the courts, etc.
Right. Well, Professor Maura Conway, thank you so much for joining me today and for sharing your insights and your expertise with us. That was really fascinating. Thank you once again.
Thanks a million, Anthony.
It's a pleasure. Thank you. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Combating Jihadist Terror. We hope you enjoyed it. If you'd like to see more episodes, they're available to watch on our website, cogid.org, or to listen to on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Thanks again.